Hello and welcome to Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. It's the podcast where I sit down with an extraordinary person and share their story. They might have overcome something amazing or they might still be on their journey with stories that will make you laugh, cry and hopefully feel a little bit inspired. So today, this is a man who believes your ambition is limited only by your attitude. And he has definitely proved this to be true over the years. Nick Hamilton was born with cerebral palsy, which affects the movement of his leg muscles, but not one to let this stop him from doing exactly what he wanted. Nick went from being told he'd always be reliant on a wheelchair to not only walking unaided, but realising his dream of becoming a racing car driver. And it's not an easy dream to realise. After earning a seat in the Renault Clio Cup, the entry-level touring car competition, Nick became the first disabled driver to compete in the British Touring Car Championship. But after financial difficulties of sponsorship arose in the money-heavy world of driving, Nick was forced to stop in his tracks for a season out of the game. But sure enough, Nick was back to it in 2018 to continue living his dream and sharing with many his view that no challenge is too big for you to conquer. What an absolute pleasure to virtually have you here with me today. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
I'm good. How did you feel hearing that intro?
Oh, I mean, it's great. I love the fact people are noticing what I do. And having someone like yourself introducing me, I feel very honoured.
Ah, well, thank you. I'm really excited to have you here. I wanted to kind of start at the beginning with you because your story definitely represents strength to me. And I wondered what your sort of childhood was like, what your memories of growing up were like, and whether you look back on that part of your life fondly or not.
Yeah. So to answer that really instantly is, if I didn't have my condition, I wouldn't be who I am today. So definitely look back on it fondly. But obviously it was a hard task. So a little bit about my life and story is, I was born 2 months premature, diagnosed with spastic diplegia, which is a form of cerebral palsy. And I wasn't breathing when I initially was born. I was whisked away to an incubator. I was in an incubator for 6 weeks. My parents couldn't hold me. My mum couldn't hold me. They were just looking at me through a plastic screen. And then they took me home and I wasn't really progressing like a usual toddler. I couldn't crawl. And when I did try and crawl, I couldn't alternate my legs. I was dragging my legs behind me sort of thing. So then they thought, oh, this is a bit odd, you know, something's not right. So they took me back to the hospital, and that was when I was diagnosed with my condition. Now, the thing with cerebral palsy, it affects so many different people in so many different ways. So I explain it like an umbrella of loads of different conditions. You've got hemiplegia down one side, and then you've got diplegia, which is both legs. So, my parents didn't really, they had my brother Lewis, who's 8 years older than me, and he's fully able-bodied, so when they had a child with CP or a disability, I think firstly they blamed themselves. Secondly, they didn't really know how to bring up a child with CP. It's not like you can go and read a book on how to bring up a child. It's like it's just a trial and error situation. It was caused from lack of oxygen to the brain with the premature birth. And I think they just made a collective decision to make my life as tough as possible. And not wrap me up in cotton wool and just basically be a nightmare. My dad is super difficult in terms of his mentality. I explain like a chocolate fondant, hard on the outside, really soft and gooey in the middle. Mm-hmm. And they don't take no for an answer. I was just brought up around able-bodied people. I was never allowed to go to a disabled school or a specialist school. I had to learn life the able-bodied way. So that changed my mentality to, well, if my parents don't see the condition as an issue, then I won't see it as an issue. And I had to just go through life to try and get on with it as possible.
I wondered, when did you see it? Because it's like I've got kids and kids aren't aware of certain things sometimes until you bring it to their attention. Like kids aren't born with any kind of prejudice at all. Like, when did you realize that there was something different?
I was just always trying to walk and trying to fit in, but just falling over, and I didn't have the strength to catch myself, so I always used to hit my head and everything. And And then as time went on, I had an operation when I was 4 years old, which was sort of life-changing. And it was a tendon release operation, which cut the back of my hamstrings, the back of my ankles, and my groin muscle, which then allowed me to have sort of almost release the spasticity a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to stand up a little bit straighter, and I was able to put my feet, my full soles of my feet on the floor, which gave me more balance. So I went through that, and then I remember, you know, sometimes just crying myself to sleep, being like, you know, why me? You know, what have I done so wrong to have this condition?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I really did notice, you know, that life was really difficult, and knew that I was different, and I really struggled to understand why and what my purpose was. And obviously now, being a 29-year-old man, you know, there's 1 in 500 births diagnosed with my condition.
Wow.
You know, so as a little kid, always around able-bodied people who seem like they have a simple life, you always look at them and think, you know, what's so great about them to be with no issues, and what did I do so wrong? So that's where I went to in terms of how I tried to start to deal with it.
Yeah, because I suppose there's an advantage of what you said about that kind of tough love and actually, you know, being brought up around all different kinds of people. But then there's also that comparison and, you know, especially when you get to like secondary school, you know, children can be ignorant, they can be mean, especially just things like if a lot of your free time was spent at physio and other kind of medical appointments when people were out playing, you know, that can be quite hard. I mean, did you, like, academically, did it affect your studies and stuff?
So when I went to school, yeah, I don't think it affected me at all in terms of my academic ability. I was just always different. You know, I was the only black person at my school, mm-hmm. and I was the only disabled person at my school.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was almost like a double whammy effect. And you're right. I had to do a lot of physiotherapy through my primary school years, and all my friends are outside playing tag or whatever at break time or lunchtime, and I'm inside with this helper who's, you know, stretching me out.
Mm.
And it's like painful homework that you never want to do, you know, and it already singles you out because you just can't hang with anybody you want.
Yeah, it makes you extra different already, doesn't it?
Completely.
Like, I know for myself, I spent like all of my 20s doing like physiotherapy, occupational therapy, and all my friends were like getting mortgages, getting engaged, getting pregnant. And I was like learning to use a cup again and just like,
and it
really like separates you, even if you try to pretend to join in with the conversation that you're not really at that level of that conversation. It can be quite hard. I just would love to know what you feel about like labels and limitations, because obviously there'll be some people listening to this that have a disability that's completely different to you. And, you know, for some people, it's not about being lazy and they haven't pushed themselves. You know, their condition has a glass ceiling and they can't go beyond that, even with the best willpower in the world. But I wanted to park that slightly and talk about when people put limitations on you. So like, say for example, after I was burnt, there were some medical people that said to my parents, she will never live a normal life and she'll always be dependent on you and have to live with you and you'll have to sort of help her. And that like sort of angered me, but sort of motivated me for that not to be my future. And, you know, looking at your story, you were told that you would never walk unaided. And actually that wasn't true. You know, at 17 years old, you did walk unaided. How hard was it? I mean, you talked about mastering it then, you know. Do you think sometimes when someone tells you that, do you think some people then just like fit into that box and say, well, that's my future, I'm not going to go beyond that? Or do you think actually it's the opposite and it pushes you to prove those people wrong?
It depends. It depends who you are now. You know, cerebral palsy affects so many people in so many different ways. And the way it affects me, I class myself as one of the lucky ones because it could be a lot worse. So it was up to me to maximize my opportunity, maximize the condition that I have, to try and make the best of it. And, you know, initially I was in a wheelchair and I was in there for 5 years and pretty much wheelchair bound and couldn't walk long distances. And, you know, people were looking down on me and bullying me at school and, you know, pushing me back in my wheelchair and just leaving me there hanging. And I just struggled to fit into general life. And then, I got to 16 and started to grow into myself as a person. You know, I was starting to grow a little bit of a beard and wanted to go hang out with my mates, and I was starting to get into girls, and I just wanted to almost try and live a bit of a normal life. But, you know, every time I went somewhere with my mum, you know, for example, is like we went to an airport to fly away with Lewis and went to check in, and this lady was just looked straight past me, straight to my mum, you know, and said, does he need assistance? Can he walk stairs? Can he do this? Can he do that? And never looked at me as a person. So I knew at that point that the only way for me to be seen and to be heard is to be on their level.
Mm.
And that means to stand up. And I'm short generally. First, my parents are not very tall. And then secondly, my legs are a little bit bent, so I lose at least 2.5 inches. So I was super, super short generally. But for me, that, you know, that was my moment. That was my time to be like, right, okay, it doesn't matter how much pain and strain and struggle I'm going to have to go through. I'm going to have to go through it to have a better future for my life. And then it wasn't up to my parents at that point. It's literally up to me, my feeling. And then as time's gone on, you know, I realize that when people tell me I can't do something, it fuels my fire even more to not necessarily prove it to them, but also prove it to myself as well. And, you know, I would say for sure, being in a wheelchair, I became very lazy. But you don't realize you're being lazy until you're a little bit older and realize, oh, you know, I didn't really do a lot with my condition there. I just almost just sat down and thought, yeah, I'm just disabled, you know, I need help. But really, you know, as time goes on, you start to grow into yourself, realize who you are, and then realize that you don't need someone to make you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're strong enough in yourself to give you that motivation, give you that strength. And at the end of the day, like I have this little motto that I carry myself with, which I made up myself, and it was just like the quick thing is, like, you know, for me, if there was a fence and I needed to get over it, I wouldn't, you know, I would have to look whether I'd climb over it, crawl through it, whether I scratch my legs over it or whatever it is, whether I'd, you know, but I don't care if people laugh at me whilst I'm trying to get over it, or I fall back a couple of times and have to start again. You know, as long as I get over it, it's all I care about.
Do what it takes. That's all that matters. Yeah. See, I love what you said as well before that about not needing other people to be happy, because society is like really obsessed with telling us that we need to own certain things by a certain age to be happy and successful.
Mm.
We need to be part of certain partnerships, relationships in order to feel worthy, to feel attractive, to feel loved. And they're not really true. Some people feel like they're written in stone and that's the only, you know, route to happiness. And that leaves a lot of people feeling quite inadequate and quite lonely. And you can sort of feel like a failure before you've even started. I'm really interested to talk about your career, because for anybody, no matter how able-bodied they are or not, this is an extremely competitive career. It's a very physical career. And you already faced, you know, a lot of letdown and a lot of discrimination in your life, and a lot of fences to either climb or throw yourself over, a lot of scratches on your legs. Did you always know that you wanted to be a racing car driver? Like, what age in your life did that become a thought in your mind?
I would say about the age of four, I always wanted to race, but never really knew whether I could or not. And I had a little go when I was 7 years old, I went to this car park and my dad said I wouldn't be able to hit anything, and I ended up hitting something and crashed and stuff like that. And that was a moment where my parents were like, right, we're not putting Nick anywhere near motorsport. You know, just gonna have to focus on his studies and schooling, and we'll just see where life takes him. So, you know, we were flying around the world with Lewis, and you know, our whole life was trying to get Lewis to where he is today.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a full family effort. It was a full family project, you know, to make him as successful as he is today. And you know, you don't see that anywhere else in Formula One. Is, you know, when you think about Lewis Hamilton, you think about his whole family, whereas most drivers, you just think about the driver on their own.
You don't know who their family are. Yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
So we pride ourselves in that. And I always wanted to race, but didn't think my condition would allow me to. And
did you tell people you had this ambition, or did you keep it secret because of that? Was it something you voiced to people?
No, not really, because once my parents said, right, you know, you crashed in your go-kart, we're not gonna allow you to do anything else. And I was like, okay, fair enough. So I just turned my attention to like gaming and simulation gaming and mm-hmm. all that sort of stuff. And I thought to myself, if I can't have a real life racing career, then I'm going to have one in the virtual world. So I picked up a game from PC World and a steering wheel, and I just learned how to drive using these buttons on a steering wheel. My legs weren't strong enough to accelerate and brake at that time. And yeah, without being really super geeky, I became British champion on this game.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Out of nowhere. You know, I'd learned everything about like car setup and racing lines and racecraft and everything like that. And then that's when Lewis said, Nick, you know, you clearly got some talent, you know, why don't you try it again for real? You know, and I'm now like 17, and you know, I've gone through my bullying stage. I'm starting to get out of my wheelchair. I'm starting to, you know, walk along longer distances, and you know, starting to be who I am. And yeah, I went to a driving school, and yeah, I matched the instructor's time on my first day. And
no way.
And then it just spiraled. It just spiraled into, wow, okay, so, you know, Nick could actually be quite decent.
That must have been great for your confidence to realize your genuine ability.
Yeah, for sure. And especially, you know, in a activity that is just purely able-bodied, really. You know, there's not very many disabled people around driving cars. And, you know, I was struggling to drive a road car, let alone put myself in a race car. So it was a big ability to realize. And then, you know, yeah, as I said, it just spiraled, went into Clio Cup, and had to train. And I knew that I wasn't able to use these hand controls now. And I wanted to make sure I could use my legs. And my legs were too weak. I could only push like 5 kilos of weight on both my legs. And I needed to get to like 100 kilos to be able to push the brake pedal effectively with my left leg. And just kept pushing and pushing, went to the gym and never stopped. And yeah, I got to 130 kilos with my left leg.
Wow.
And then, yeah, just carried on from there and started racing. I had a documentary on me by the BBC, and yeah, you know, I was popping ribs and my pelvis was moving every time I was in a car.
Oh, goodness.
And I just wanted to race. That's all I wanted to do. And I didn't really care about inspiring people, but once I got a little taste of it, that people were coming to my races to watch me race. And, you know, it was people that were disabled or had a disabled child or something like that, someone that could relate to it, my whole purpose changed. And and then it takes me back to the days where I cried myself to sleep, understand why I was the way I was, and now I realized that my purpose was to use my condition to inspire others. And you know, my motorsport is the reason that gets me up in the morning to keep fighting.
Do you ever wonder how celebrities order food? Like, is Sarah Paulson a Diet Coke or a regular Coke girlie?
Some peasant Coke? No.
Or how does Sofia Vergara order a pizza?
No, no tomatoes. I cannot eat tomatoes.
Yes. Are you killed mushrooms?
Not really.
Okay. If these are the details you need, and I know you do, I have the podcast for you. I'm Jesse Tyler Ferguson, and on my podcast, Dinner's on Me, I take some notable friends of mine out to dinners in Los Angeles and New York City. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
That thing was delicious.
It's an amazing thing because, like you said, you don't go out of your way to inspire people. You just exist and live your life to your potential. I have someone in my life whose child has cerebral palsy, someone who's close to me, and I can't wait for them to hear this interview because, you know, it's not about showing people, oh, look, they're just like you and they exist. It's about saying they have similarities to you and they have goals, they have dreams, and they've fulfilled a lot of those. And actually, you know, it's as exciting for the child as it is the parent as well to see actually that this could be what my child could be capable of. I wondered if when you were doing this and, you know, it was going really well, despite ribs and pelvises popping, were there kind of negative people and naysayers saying, you shouldn't be doing this, stop now, you're doing the wrong thing, go get a job in Tesco. Like, yeah, I had that myself when I was setting up my charity, and people like, you're not experienced in this field, you should go get a job doing hairdressing. Or, you know, you do get those people that basically project their fears onto you.
So obviously right now I'm in the British Touring Car Championship. So the pinnacle of British motorsport, you can't go any higher in the UK. You know, first disabled athlete to compete in the series, first disabled athlete to score points in the series. And I would say I'm one of the most, if not the most followed driver on the grid. But also I personally feel I'm like the most liked driver, but also the most hated driver at the same
really?
Time.
Really? Like, why is that?
That's how I feel. People are brutal. They're like, they feel like they've got so much to say. They feel like they know they can just sit, be keyboard warriors, say whatever they want to say and give people a load of grief and rubbish. And so, you know, there was, you know, times where it's, you know, I signed for a team and people say how much of a waste it is. And, you know, I don't deserve to be there. And, you know, I'm only there because of Lewis, and I'm only there because of the name, and I'm only there because of this, and I'm only there because of that. And, you know, and it just gets to the point you don't read those sort of comments, or you don't read those sort of people's thoughts. And it was just difficult.
Yeah. Cause sometimes I feel like your strength can make people feel weak, and it makes them feel inadequate, and it makes them lash out like that. Because it intimidates them and it shows them up for what they're not, where they're not showing up in their own life, you know? Mm-hmm. So they can only really kind of counteract that by sort of trying to say, well, you're only there because of X, Y, or Z. Or I did wonder, I mean, we talked a bit about Lewis, and I didn't really want to talk too much about him because I imagine the comparison has been there throughout your whole career. You know, I've got a younger sister and we're not even in the same career. And I know what it's like for the younger sibling. When you've got the older sibling, no matter what they do, there's always that comparison. And I wondered, as supportive of you have all been as a family of him, has there been some negatives between having a sibling in the same world as you in the same career?
For sure. You know, firstly, being a Hamilton never was a thing. We were just a normal family. You know, we struggled for money. We were poor. We didn't know what to do. We didn't really have much direction, you know, and now the Hamilton name is a household name. You know, most people in the UK, most people in the world know who Lewis Hamilton is now, 7-time former world champion and a sir. So as time's gone on, obviously it becomes a responsibility because, as I said at the start of this podcast, it's the whole family that are known, not just the driver, not just Lewis. So, you know, I might be at a petrol station, I might be eating food or something like that, and I'll get noticed by literally not doing anything. So I've got to make sure I'm not picking my nose or doing anything. Do you know what I mean? Like it's sneezing in the wrong way or anything like that. And you know, it's all about people's perception of you and
first impression.
First impressions are really important.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, I have it everywhere I go. And especially when you're trying to do it in the same industry where Lewis is pretty much, you know, he's dominating that industry. Mm. He's the top of that industry. Plus, you know, he has a load of money, and motorsport is money makes the world go round generally, but motorsport is all about finance and funding and everything like that. And so, you know, getting sponsors helps you get through the door being a Hamilton, but also can close doors because they're like, well, you know, why doesn't Lewis just give you the money to race or this or that? So it's a double-edged sword, really. You know, can really help you and then can really hinder you in certain aspects. And then also when it comes to performances, you know, no one really cares when someone else makes a mistake and goes off the circuit or whatever. But for me, if I make a single mistake, it's on websites, it's in magazines.
You're under the magnifying glass because...
Always.
Yeah. What would you say, because a lot of people who listen to this will be female, you know, a lot of the people that listen to this podcast are women, so probably don't know loads about motorsport. I have to confess, I didn't until I started researching you. Now I feel like I know loads.
No worries, it's great.
What would you say it takes to be a top racing driver?
Well, that's a great question. I would say you've got to be the full package, right? You've got to be strong off circuit as well as strong on circuit. And when you're strong on circuit, you have to have a level of arrogance. excuse my language, but zero fucks given almost. Do you know what
yeah,
I mean?
That's a good attitude for life in general. No sure. fucks given.
But you also have to be very calculated in your decisions, you know, because everything is split second. You know, in what we do, there's 29 cars hurtling down to turn one at 140 mile an hour, and everything.
Oh, if I was your mum, I couldn't watch. Honestly, it makes yeah. me feel sick talking about it.
Everything can change in a split second, so you have to just, you know, drive the situation or the race in front of you and make split fast decisions. And so it's about having, you know, good raw pace, but also good strategical decisions in your locker, and also, you know, being a decent person off circuit as well to help you progress.
What about your peers? How what is it like? Because obviously, like, you're talking about success and it's a competitive world. Like, how do you find it dealing with your peers in your industry?
You know, I received, you know, a lot of rubbish generally. You know, I don't think anyone likes to be beaten by a disabled person, especially when I'm the only one there. And mm-hmm. and, you know, I like to class myself as a Paralympian in the Olympics, you know,
yeah.
because there's no one with my condition at this level. And it must feel awful for them to see a disabled guy steam up the inside and drive away from them. So, you know,
I felt so much glee in your voice then when you said that.
you know, but that's great. That's you know what I strive to do. And at the end of the day, I want to try and get to the top of the championship or stand on the podium of a British Touring Car Championship race. And I'm not going to stop until I get there.
It's quite amazing because, you know, I think, like, I love sport, I love running, I love weight training, and, you know, for mental and physical reasons. And I think sport is sort of famous for promoting that mental and physical strength, also discipline, teamwork. And I wondered, has driving taught you anything? You know, obviously you bring a lot to the table already, but has it taught you stuff? Has it changed you?
I would say, you know, you learn from a lot of your mistakes, and motorsport, it really magnifies your mistakes as a person, as an athlete. You know, it can be from your relationships with your team manager, or the relationships with your mechanics, or how you carry yourself through team meetings, and whether you bring the team down or how you pick them up, and then how you perform in the car. And then when you make a mistake, how you deal with that, how you are perceived, you know, when things go wrong. And yeah, this whole racing malarkey for me has completely changed my attitude as a person, because initially you just think you just want to get in the car and drive, and then, you know, you just make a mistake, go and crash the car, and you're like, oh, well, I got the mechanics that will fix it. But really, these people are human. Yeah, it's their job. That's what they're mm-hmm. paid to do. But still, you know, they've got a lot of work to do. So, you know, you always got to think about other people, and then you got to always pick them up and be grateful for what they do, because really you want them to give them your all. You want the car to be the best it can be so that you can be at your best when you drive it. You know, but then it goes deeper than that. You know, it goes into relationships with your partners, the people that support you, the people that have invested into your journey, you know, understanding who they are as a business, as people as well. And that they're also struggling through COVID or the pandemic or anything like that. And everyone is just a human that needs help every now and then. And just because they're supporting your success story or what you're doing doesn't mean you shouldn't take notice of it. So I think this whole procedure that I've gone through from life of my condition to wanting to race, to then not having the funding to race, you know, and not having the relationships to race, it's taught me so many different things to be able to get to where I am today.
I wondered, because it's quite a consuming career, and I wondered, what is your work-life balance like, and do you have anything you enjoy doing outside driving, or is there just simply not time for that?
I'm a true grafter, and I never stop, and nothing is ever enough, But some days I just realize, you know, it's time just to relax and chill out. You know, we had our first race last weekend, which was a really good weekend. And yeah, you have to relax mentally for a bit. And to do that, I play games, you know. I'm a big gamer. So, you know,
yeah.
I don't go to the pub or go out, get drunk. I just keep myself to myself.
But that's a nice way to unwind, isn't it? Because I guess when you're gaming, you're just in that zone. You're not thinking about other stuff and you're just... That I like to go running and I like to listen to podcasts when I'm running. And that's my way of like just unwinding because I can't just sit still and meditate. I'm not that person. You know, I like to do something to unwind. So,
yeah. I mean, for me, I just put my headphones on and it just takes me away from the world and the stresses that I have, because, you know, I have a lot of stresses going on in my life. And gaming just completely takes me away from that. So it doesn't matter how old I'm going to be and when I've got kids and everything like that, I'm still going to have some time to myself, a bit of Nick time. And that Nick time is definitely playing Call of Duty or gaming or whatever it is. And it also brings me and my brother closer as well. So, you know, it's a positive thing that way.
So you mentioned their children. Is that, I mean, you're still quite young. You're 29. It's young for a guy. Is starting a family something that you want to do?
Of course I would. Firstly, I always wanted a little sister and I never got one. So my next thing is to have a daughter. You know, I think they're absolutely incredible. And you know, starting a family would be a really cool thing. Growing up, I didn't even think I'd be able to do that with my condition. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't even think, you know, having intercourse would be possible. Do you know what I mean? Mm. You go through so many different mindsets and emotions and feelings, as a kid, cause you're like, okay, so am I going to be affected in that area? Or, you mm-hmm. know, is that, will girls find me attractive? You know, will they look past the disability and will I have the normal opportunities of finding love and companionship and all that stuff?
Of course. Everyone worries about that with or without a visible difference, you mm-hmm. know, but extremely more heightened when you're not the same as your peer group. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I've seen a couple of people, or maybe probably one person who has the same condition as me, and I saw him at an event years and years ago, and he had a child on his shoulders. So I was like, oh, okay, well, you know, it's possible. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, now I know it definitely is. And yeah, I think a family would be an amazing thing for me to create. But I want to do that when I'm secure, I'd say, where I am in my life. And you know, because once a kid is brought into this world, I want to make sure I can devote everything to them. I don't want to be still searching for myself and searching for things to make my life better.
When you said that you recited that story of seeing that guy with a kid on his shoulders, it just gave me like a rush feeling in my stomach, because I know how powerful it is. Like that, you can't be what you don't see. And I know how powerful it is to see someone that you feel represents you doing the things you think are taken away from you. Mm. You know, I remember the first time I met a woman who had a full facial burn and she was married. And I remember thinking, oh, someone fancies her and they've married her. Yeah. And I was just like, maybe I will have a boyfriend. Like maybe there are people that aren't shallow in this world. And, you know, her burns were visible. And it's really hard to explain to people unless they've been in that situation, the genuine hope it gives you, because people that aren't within that and like your parents telling you you're going to be happy, like it's not very effective. It's actually almost a little bit patronizing because it's not really a real example. Mm. And I suppose it's quite a nice way to wrap up the podcast, really, because I don't think you have to be an aspiring sports person to gain great motivation from your story. Like, you motivate me with my life, even though I have no aspiration to go beyond my Golf GTI. I'm a terrible driver. And I just wondered, you know, you're 29 years old, and I just wondered, like, as a sort of final thought, if there's people sort of listening today, you know, who are having a good day, a bad day, a weird day, is there like a key piece of advice you'd give to them? Or even people that are in the position that you were in when you were younger, with feeling that they're limited for some reason, what kind of what would be your parting thing for them to take from this episode?
How I go through my life is believing that life is 10% physical and 90% mental. So it doesn't really matter your physical limitations or how physically fit you might be. If your mentality isn't strong enough, you know, then you're never gonna achieve your full potential. And so my main thing would be to open your mind up, and instead of trying to ignore the fact that maybe you might be struggling mentally in certain areas, it's okay. It's okay to not be okay. It's okay to have difficult days, down days, tough days, days where you don't think there's literally any point of doing a certain task. Every down day is just a character building day to move forward. And with each obstacle that you have to face, and that you do face eventually and overcome, it makes the next obstacle a lot easier. Always be kind, always be open to helping people, but also mainly just be true to yourself. And it doesn't matter what people think about you or their perception of you. All that matters is how you feel about yourself, and you don't need anybody to make you feel better, or to tell you you're doing great, because as long as you're breathing still, and as long as you're smiling and getting up every day and focusing on whatever direction you want to put yourself in, then you're doing just fine.
Oh, I think this is going to be my favorite episode of the series. This is so brilliant. Honestly, it's so uplifting. And it's so true what you're saying. Like, we can all apply this to our lives. Like, we all have the capacity to be great. Like, we don't have to rely on anything else. I can just shut the laptop after here and just go and be great all day. You know, yeah, I don't need anyone else.
Like, there's this one quote that I read a couple of days ago was, if you can see greatness, you're already great, which was really,
which is a really
good quote. You know, if you can notice greatness or see greatness in other people, then you're already great within yourself.
You're going to see me put that on Twitter with my name next to it, yeah, like next week. I've had so much fun recording this with you.
No, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, you're just such an interesting, fascinating, and I know it's a bit of an overused word, but inspiring guy.
No, like, thank you. But, yeah, you know, to be fair, Katie, I was more interested in listening to your story.
Oh, if you start a podcast, let me know. It's been so great, and no, you have been extraordinary. So thank you so much for sharing all aspects of your life. No. It's really great how open you are.
Thank you, Katie. Appreciate it.
Do you know what? I overran slightly, but I didn't want to stop because you've got so many different sides to you. It's so interesting.
Like, you can cut it, chop it and change it to however you want it.
Thanks for listening to Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. If you haven't already, please follow where you get your podcasts. Also, if you enjoyed this, please help us spread the word. Rate and review the show or share on your socials.